gave the city a certain vibrancy, a certain cultural vibrancy in the course of the first century BC. But we shouldn't forget that most of these people are living really in extremely poor conditions. And this is one aspect of the Roman Revolution that's often neglected. I wouldn't propose that the Roman Revolution was a Marxist type of an event with the poor rising up against oppression by the rich. That's manifestly not the case. And looking at the facts, it's clearly primarily a competition among the privileged for dominance of the state. But what is remarkable and is often overlooked is the ease with which desperados seem to be able to raise gangs of ruffians to control the streets of Rome, or when matters get really bad, can go out into the countryside and raise an army. Marcus Aemilius Lepidus did this in 78 BC, Catiline did it in 63 BC. There's no reason to believe that all of Spartacus's adherents were all slaves. Many of them were probably dispossessed, destitute people who were simply not catered for in the Roman system. This is not a welfare state. If you lose your property or if you have no property, you have to rely on state handouts after Clodius's free grain distributions of 58 BC onwards, or your own labour, or you have to resort to crime. So there must be large population, there must be a fairly large population of Italy that's willing to join these people who are challenging the established order, and that's something that we should bear in mind, and as a product of the social and economic developments of the late Republic. I've mentioned that the Hellenization of Rome at this stage is largely complete, and that's absolutely clear to us. We can see, as I've already mentioned, in the case of Pompey's theatre, large quantities of Greek sculpture displayed in that particular structure. There's nothing left of Pompey's theatre to see today, although if you do go to the part of the city of Rome where it stood, some of the streets follow the curved shape of the old theatre, and presumably in the basements of those houses and apartment blocks there are remains of the foundations of the theatre to be seen. But the Greek sculpture that adorned Pompey's theatre is well known, and certainly after Sulla's campaigns in the east, vast quantities of plunder artwork made their way over to Italy from the east. And striking confirmation of this emerged out of the waters of the Mediterranean in 1972, when a Roman ship was excavated off the coast of Italy, South Italy, at a place called Riace, and two magnificent Greek bronze statues emerged from the waters. They were in a Roman ship that was dated to the first century BC. It mightn't be one of the ships that we know Sulla used to transport vast amounts of wealth from the east, but it's certainly of that ilk. Clearly here we have Greek statuary, original Greek statuary, uprooted from its original place, wherever that was, put on a Roman ship and was on its way to Italy when the ship sank for us to find. We must also remember as well the vast numbers of artisans, philosophers, thinkers, experts of all sorts who came to Rome in the hope of making it big. Philosophers would come and establish schools of thought. At this stage, the Roman educational system is thoroughly Hellenized, and it's quite normal for a young man in his middle teens to spend some time in the company of a rhetor, of a trained Greek speaker who will give him the art of oratory, which was so important, of course, to persuading one's peers in the Senate and in front of the mob and so forth, gave one power as well. So we do have professional philosophers and thinkers who are establishing schools in Rome, and doctors as well. I find particularly intriguing the doctor Asclepiades of Bithynia, who had a real harebrained physiological theory involving the body being made up of lumps of matter and pores, and the whole idea being to try and keep the balance of lumps and pores equal, so that's what maintained health. And you did this by doing all kinds of pleasant things. You drank wine, you rocked gently in chairs, you took baths, and so not surprisingly, he became incredibly popular. He's basically telling people, do things that you enjoy and you'll stay healthy. You know, exercise only mildly, don't ever overdo it. And in the case of Asclepiades, he became immensely popular. In fact, a detailed study by a leading scholar of the intellectual life of the late Republic has gone so far as to claim that Asclepiades may have been the single most influential Greek thinker in Rome at this time, and he's hardly known at all in the main textbooks. But Asclepiades, from Bithynia, from the area of northern Turkey, coming to spend probably 30 years or more in Rome, in the company of important men, gaining great fame and wealth in the city in this time. Altogether, illustrative of the flocking to Rome of people from the east, people from the eastern half of the empire. In the area of literature, we don't have too much time to spend on literature. I did mention that it's something that we will not have time to look at in any great detail in this course, but we can at least mention that the late Republic sees the flowering of several very important authors, all of whom used Greek models to formulate their particular genres. I'll just take three examples. The poet Catullus used the elegies of the Greek poet Callimachus to produce an entirely new sort, a wholly new sort of Latin poetry. He didn't translate Callimachus, he used Callimachus's lyric poems as a model, and then created a new form of Latin poetry, an intensely personal form of poetry in which he described, above all else, a disastrous love affair with a woman called Lesbia, who in all probability, at least in the views of most commentators, is to be identified as Clodia, the sister of Publius Clodius Pulcher, the infamous tribune and enemy of Cicero's. There's also the historian Sallust, who looked to the mid-5th century BC Athenian historian Thucydides as his model and created a new Latin style working from Thucydides. He made this new Latin style of history writing. History writing, it seems, was prone to be quite florid, very sort of Ciceronian, if you want to think of it that way, in its composition. Sallust is a much more staccato and rapid-fire, uneasy, shifting type of style that he evolved, specifically looking at his Greek model, Thucydides. And a very strange document indeed, but a major author of this period, Lucretius, wrote a very lengthy poem which expounds in verse the Greek philosophy of Epicureanism. The poem is called About Everything, well, De Natura, about the nature of things. It's a strange sort of poem, but it's basically a philosophical manifesto in verse, in Latin, and it's a philosophical manifesto of a Greek school of philosophy. But there's no doubt that the towering cultural figure of this period, and the one who's exerted the greatest influence in subsequent years, is Marcus Tullius Cicero. Cicero's life and his writings really do reflect in no small way so much of the society and culture and expectations of his era. Cicero was from Arpinum, from the same town that had given rise to Gaius Marius, and he came to Rome as a young man to get educated. That itself is interesting. Rome has become a place of education. There are sufficient schools of thought and so on in the city that this is where naturally the elite, even of the Italian countryside, will go. They'll naturally gravitate towards Rome to make it big. Like any young man, he harbored political ambitions, but he was a markedly unmilitary type of figure. He didn't like the military life and chose instead to use the courts rather than the army as his avenue for success. I should mention in passing, to set the context, that the courts of ancient Rome, certainly the courts of the late Republic, were as much arenas of political conflict as were the popular assemblies or the Senate House. One was constantly prosecuting one's opponents in the courts. The courts took place out in the open, in the forum, in the same place as the popular assemblies did. They weren't dignified, majestic affairs, the way ours are at least supposed to be, with judges hitting the bench and saying, order in court, silence, and so forth. They were quite rowdy affairs. Juries would be arrayed with the prosecution on one side and the defense on the other, sitting on benches and their supporters grouped around. And then there would be, around the court, there would be a circle of observers, hangers-on, people who were loitering in the forum and who were watching what's going on. And so the advocate would appeal as well to the reactions of the mob, of the crowd, and could influence the judge's decision that way as well. So the courts then are places as much of political theater as they are of justice. And this is how Cicero made himself known. He started off defending people and then prosecuting people, really became known as an excellent orator, a fine speaker, a fine craftsman with the Latin language. And so he gained some kudos among the nobility, but he was never accepted by them. He was an outsider. He was a new man from what the Romans would have considered the countryside, from a small town. And as a result, he never gained full acceptance with them. But he did rise up the courses, as we've seen, and reached the consulship in 63 BC, and tried as far as he could to gain acceptance with the nobility, never fully succeeding, however. Rather, sort of, in some ways, a pathetic figure for that reason. But in his downtime, in the periods where he wasn't actively involved in politics, he spent his time writing. And this is his greatest legacy to the world. His political career is hardly known to anyone, but his writings must surely be. He wrote dozens of speeches, of which 58 survive. They are both political speeches and they are forensic speeches. They make for fascinating reading, especially the forensic speeches. You can imagine the situation in the court, Cicero using the cleverest of arguments, often ignoring evidence completely, just using the power of an argument to get clients who seem to be manifestly guilty off, and succeeding in doing so. It's quite remarkable. These speeches would have been delivered without notes continuously to the crowd. Some of them maybe would have taken several hours to deliver. So they're mentally remarkable acts in themselves. They were, of course, written up and published later, and there's a big debate as to how much the text of the speeches we have reflects what was actually said on the day, and that's just something that we cannot, I'm afraid, cannot get behind. He also wrote 19 treatises on various matters. He wrote one about the state, De Republica. He wrote one about the nature of the gods, on duty and so forth. So he wrote a series of what are essentially philosophical treatises, clearly drawing from a profound knowledge of the Greek sources. Cicero's thoroughly Hellenized in every respect. And more than anything else, he wrote letters. And these letters are an invaluable source for these years. Because the letters were not intended by Cicero to be published. They were found among his papers by his secretary, Tiro, after his death. And they were published posthumously, without Cicero's ever having looked over them to work them up into a literary entity. And as a result, they're incredibly interesting documents. They are the private correspondence of a leading man of his day writing about some of these major figures. Caesar, Clodius, Milo, Pompey march across the pages frequently. Cicero describing his reactions to them and what they're like as people, at least in his view. Really, without the letters and the speeches of Cicero, our knowledge of the late Republic would be greatly impoverished. We would not be able to have nearly as much detail about the events in Rome as we're able to provide. They're an invaluable source, and I just want to end by giving you a passage from one of the letters of Cicero to his friend Atticus, in which he is writing in the middle of 60 BC. Caesar is outside the gates, and he's going to come in for the consulship, and the first triumvirate is just about to be formed. This, of course, is unknown to Cicero as he's writing. He writes, "In a mild sort of way, you take me to task for my friendly relations with Pompey. I should not wish you to think that I have drawn close to him for my own protection. The position, however, was that any dissension that might arise between us would inevitably bring major political conflicts in its train. If I have foreseen and provided against this danger, that does not mean that I have abandoned my own constitutionalist policy, but that he has become more constitutionally minded and less inclined to court popularity with the masses at the expense of principle." If I may intercede, that's a complete misreading of Pompey, who's about to embark on his relations with Crassus and Caesar and support Caesar's massively popularist behavior in the period of 59 BC. Anyway, and to return. "You may be interested to learn that he eulogizes my achievements, which many persons had prompted him to attack, in far more glowing terms than his own, acknowledging himself as a good servant of the state, but me as its savior. How much I gain by his doing so, I hardly know, but there is certainly a gain to the Republic. I will go even further. Supposing I managed to make Caesar, who was riding on the crest of a wave just now, a better citizen, am I harming the state so very much? Well, even if I had no ill-wishers, even if I had everyone's goodwill, as I ought to have, there would still be as much to be said for healing the unsound members of the body politic as for amputating them. With Caesar, as with Pompey, Cicero is completely wrong. He has completely misread Caesar, but it is precisely our ability to see that that makes his letters such valuable evidence."
Lecture 29, Antony and Octavian.
Welcome to the 29th lecture in the history of ancient Rome. This will be our most narrowly focused lecture in terms of the time period covered, barely 20 months from March 44 to October 43 BC. But it's a crucial period, one well worth looking at in some detail, since it brings into play a man who will be of vital importance for the future of Roman history, a man who would in fact recast the Republic, the Res Publica, into an autocracy and generate a system of government that was to stand for the best part of 300 years. That man is Augustus, and we're going to be examining today the very earliest stages of his career, of his emergence onto the stage of Roman politics. We pick up the narrative at the point of Caesar's assassination. We had seen him cut down by a cabal of senators, many of them ex-Pompeians spared by Caesar in the civil wars, but quite a few of them members of his own party, of his own support group, former officers and lieutenants, who had become disillusioned with Caesar's increasingly autocratic and unacceptable behaviour. In the wake of the assassination of Caesar, the pandemonium ensued. The liberators, so-called, the assassins, had made no moves, as we'd seen, or had made no plans to assassinate anyone else other than Caesar. They had decided that they wanted to appear as tyrannicides, men who were ridding the state of an evil ruler, and to have attacked others would have appeared begrudging, perhaps would have undermined their motives in the eyes of many. So they left the rest of the Caesarian faction, particularly the man known as Mark Antony, to us Marcus Antonius in his original form, who was Caesar's right-hand man. He was consul for the year 44 BC and had spent many years campaigning with Caesar, was an experienced officer. At this stage, he was 39 years of age and was a well-respected and well-known figure within the Caesarian camp. He was left unmolested by the liberators. Remarkably, the liberators made no moves to garner any further support for themselves. They didn't try and get any military support for themselves from armies outside of Rome, in the provinces, for instance. They just seemed to have been motivated by an ideological belief that their deed would be widely recognized and praised as that of an act of liberation, and their coinage certainly makes that clear. Their coinage shows daggers and a cap that represents freedom. It's a cap that was given to freed slaves, and so it represents the freedom of the state from slavery under Caesar, with the inscription Ides of March written on it. So they seem to have been motivated really by a sense of ideological righteousness, and they made no real efforts in real terms to garner support for themselves. They realized that they may have miscalculated very early on. They came rushing out of the meeting room in the portico behind the theater of Pompeii, where the assassination had taken place, out into the people outside, into the mob, expecting, I suppose, to be praised and lauded for their actions. And they met instead with a rather sullen reception on the part of the crowd. The crowd had always been very fond of Caesar, even if they'd found his behavior in recent months somewhat disappointing. But they generally always were well disposed towards him. He treated them well and had catered to their needs nicely. And they weren't overly impressed by the fact that he'd been murdered whilst in the Senate House. And it didn't help the fact that many of the people in Rome at the time were veterans of Caesar's who had come to the city to see him off on his great campaign that was supposed to be only 4 days away. He was planning to leave Rome and embark on a massive campaign against the Parthians to avenge the death of Crassus in 53. And a further sign, by the way, of Caesar's lack of interest in really trying to recast the Roman state into something different and give it a new basis of government. He was just going to leave and probably spend years away in the east. But many of his veterans who weren't going to go on that campaign had come to the city to wish him off, to see him off with their well wishes, and they weren't impressed when they found out that he'd been murdered at a meeting of the Senate House. So as a result, there was something of a standoff. The liberators, in fear, withdrew onto the Capitol Hill, which was the old highest point of Rome, the old sort of acropolis of ancient Rome, if you like, the fortress in the city. And they withdrew up there. And in doing so, they basically handed the initiative over to the Caesarian camp. It's a remarkable act on their part. They made some efforts to convince the people that they'd done the right thing. They weren't happy with the response that they got, so they withdrew effectively from affairs and handed initiative to Mark Antony. Mark Antony was an able chap, an experienced politician and soldier, with plenty of connections and lots of respect among the Caesarian faction. And he set about organizing popular opinion against the assassination of Caesar, whilst at the same time dealing with the liberators. He sort of keeping them on board slightly, whilst working towards undermining their position. So he played a very delicate game in these first few weeks and days following the assassination. He summoned a meeting of the Senate on the 17th of March, for instance, and at that he had a public funeral for Caesar voted, declared. The funeral was staged shortly afterwards in the very centre of Rome in the Forum itself and proved to be a rather interesting affair. At this funeral, or just beforehand, Caesar's will was opened and read to the populace. In it, Caesar gave some gardens that he owned to the people, and he gave each Roman citizen living in the city of Rome 300 sesterces, which is quite a sum of money, in his will as a handout. People's memory of their former patron, their beloved Caesar, was all the more heightened by this revelation. They also were shocked to see the body of Caesar itself, which was all cut up and bloodied in its toga. And Antony played upon these emotions in a histrionic speech. We don't have the text of it, despite Shakespeare's wonderful reconstruction. We don't know what he actually said, but we do know it was a histrionic type of a performance which whipped the crowd up into a frenzy of vengeance against the liberators, who had been watching all this from the Capitol Hill overlooking the Forum, and sensing the coming ugliness, had discreetly made exits out of the city before things got too bad. But the result was there was quite a lot of disorder and rioting at the funeral, and Antony had gained the upper hand. He had turned the people around in his favour and in the favour of Caesar, and effectively driven the liberators out of the city. Antony then seemed to be standing supreme within the Caesarian camp. All of this now taking place within days of the assassination on the 15th of March. But Caesar's will contained a further surprise that no one expected. In the will, Caesar adopted his great nephew, Gaius Octavius, a boy of merely 18 at this stage in his life in March 44. He wasn't of particularly august origins. His natural father was local from a town north of Rome, so he really didn't have any great connections. He was largely untried. He had met Caesar once. Caesar had obviously been impressed about some qualities that he saw in the young man, for he adopted him as his son in his will and made him his chief heir. Now, I should point out that in Roman eyes, the legal adoption of a person gave that person every claim, not just to the property and patrimony of the adopting party, but also to the heritage, the political connections, the name, the dignitas, everything else that came with the adoption. The Romans really made no serious distinction between a natural and an adopted son. It wasn't considered like the adopted son was an impostor or some kind of a late claimant. He was simply considered as if he had been born of the adopting party. And so Gaius Octavius, at that time, when he became adopted, took the name Gaius Julius Caesar Octavianus. This was the traditional formulation for adoptees in the Roman system. And he's hereafter known by modern scholars as Octavian. This is how he's referred to, and it's how I shall refer to him in this period of his career. But I should stress that as far as the ancients were concerned, he was called Caesar. And that's certainly the name that he wanted to be known by. And we'll see why in a second. In March 44 BC, the young Octavius, soon to be Octavian, was across the Adriatic, preparing to join Caesar on his Parthian campaign. He heard of the assassination, and he moved into South Italy, where family members and friends urged him to renounce the adoption. They figured it was dangerous to his life. He is, after all, only an 18-year-old, even by our standards a young man, but by Roman standards practically a child. Most Roman politicians, especially the likes of Mark Antony, were men in their 30s and 40s, with a long career of making connections and developing a nexus of support. Octavian had none of that. He was really an unknown entity, untried entity, and by being adopted by Caesar, some of his supporters and family members felt that his life was in grave danger, either from the liberators or perhaps from a jealous Mark Antony. He showed immediately a resoluteness and a boldness that was to mark so much of his career. Rather than renouncing the adoption and the inheritance, he travelled to the town of Brundisium in South Italy, where some of Caesar's veterans were located, and calling himself Caesar, son of Caesar, he garnered their loyalty and support. And then he began proceeding towards Rome. This would have been in late March and early April. As he went towards Rome, he passed through towns and colonies settled by Caesar's veterans, and more people joined his retinue. He was the son of their hero, of their patron, and so he could lay claim to their loyalties. Antony, interestingly enough, ignored all of this. One would have expected that he might send out a delegation to inquire as to Octavian's intentions, put out some feelers in his direction. He did nothing of the sort. Octavian proceeded all the way to Rome, his retinue growing all the time, and arrived there towards the end of April in 44 BC. Still no word from Antony. Octavian then went to the forum and formally accepted his adoption by Caesar and then legally became Gaius Julius Caesar Octavianus, calling himself Caesar. He then went to see Antony, who was in the gardens of Pompeii, of all places, in one of the porticos around Pompeii's theatre, it seems. Antony kept the boy waiting. He finally brought him in to his presence, and the meeting did not go well. Antony was overly defensive. Octavian struck Antony as brash, not sufficiently deferential to Antony's position and seniority. Octavian made demands that the substantial inheritance that was due to him from Caesar's will as Caesar's son and chief heir should be paid. Antony vacillated, said some of the money was tied up in contestation, some of it had been spent. Anyway, it hadn't all been counted, we don't know how much there is. Come back some other time. You can't have any money, basically. Octavian felt snubbed and insulted, and the meeting ended rather badly. Both men suspicious of each other. As this situation was going on, the Senate was caught very much in the middle. It had now plenty of pro-Caesar members in its ranks. Caesar had appointed plenty of people into the Senate who were his own supporters. Some supported Caesar, some supported the liberators, some sat on the fence in between waiting to see what would happen. The Senate's confusion is nicely illustrated by its decisions on the 17th of March, the meeting summoned by Mark Antony shortly after the assassination. On the one hand, an amnesty was declared for the liberators. Their act was not to be considered a murder. They weren't to be prosecuted. On the other hand, all of Caesar's acts and deeds were ratified. So Caesar is at once honoured, and a public funeral was voted. So Caesar's honoured somehow, not fully condemned, but the liberators are not lauded and fully endorsed in their act of tyrannicide either. So the Senate sits on the fence. There then follows some squabbling over the assignation of provinces that I won't go into in a great amount of detail, but the Senate, showing its vacillation further, assigned Antony to a province in Macedonia and gave the liberators also some provinces. Some members of the party of assassins are getting provinces and commands, and so are members of the Caesarian party. This is not a good policy, because you're essentially equipping and arming two sides that are going to have great difficulty living together. Antony, sometime in June of 44, decided that he didn't like the provinces assigned to him by the Senate and pushed through a popular bill assigning himself further provinces, particularly nearer Gaul, or Gaul this side of the Alps, Cisalpine Gaul, and Transalpine Gaul, Gaul across the Alps. This decision was to have serious ramifications. Because in Cisalpine Gaul, already established, was one of the liberators, a man called Decimus Brutus, not the famous Brutus, who was called Marcus Brutus, but Decimus Brutus, who was already in Gaul as Caesar's appointee to that province for the year 44. Antony decided that he wanted to take over Cisalpine Gaul before Brutus's command was up and moved into the region late in 44. Decimus Brutus considered Antony's claim on his province illegitimate and illegal, and Antony's move in his direction to be illegal, and refused to quit the province. And for the first time, two men, armed, one Caesarian, one a liberator, are facing off in what is today northern Italy, in the Po Valley area, in Cisalpine Gaul. Shortly before moving into Cisalpine Gaul and starting off the first round of conflicts between the Caesarians and the liberators, the first armed conflicts anyway, Antony also decided to make an attempt to neutralize Octavian, whom he now regarded as a threat. He trumped up the charge that Octavian was trying to assassinate him. In response, Octavian carried out another incredibly bold move that really could have ended his career rapidly. He went around to Caesar's veterans in southern Italy, in the area of Campania, and raised, on his own money, 2 legions of troops. In doing so, he could have been branded a public enemy, a brigand. He could have found himself outlawed. It was an incredibly gutsy move for a guy who, at this stage, he's 19 years old. But the ploy worked. Antony was bringing troops over from Macedonia to move up into Cisalpine Gaul, 4 legions to be exact. 2 of them defected to Caesar, to Octavian. Antony found himself 2 legions less. Octavian now had 4 legions, 2 of his own and 2 from Antony's. The situation was so perilous for Antony that at a meeting of the Senate where he was going to have Octavian declared a public enemy, he didn't even put the matter to a vote. He couldn't trust the loyalty of his own troops. Despite the fact that he pleaded with them and tried to bribe them to stay loyal to him, they were pulled by the name Caesar and the son of Caesar into their loyalty, and their loyalties were directed at Octavian. So what we see shaping up then is a very perilous situation. It's really a two-sided, double power struggle. On the one hand, we have the liberators. At the moment, their most hard-pressed member being Decimus Brutus in Cisalpine Gaul, facing Antony, who's now approaching, laying claim to that province. On the other hand, stands Antony versus Octavian within the Caesarian camp itself. Complex situation, all shaping up in the matter of months following the death of Caesar. It's why this period requires a somewhat closer analysis than we've been giving to most of the rest of the Roman Revolution. Well, the conflict between Antony and Decimus Brutus is generally called in our sources the War of Mutina, which is the town where Decimus Brutus found himself besieged by Antony's forces in late winter of 44 into the early part of 43. The Senate decided to stand by Decimus Brutus, who they regarded as the legitimate governor of Cisalpine Gaul. Cicero particularly emerged to tremendous prominence at this time by issuing a series of vitriolic attacks against Mark Antony, which have survived and are called the Philippics, a series of speeches in which himself and Antony, we don't have Antony's responses to Cicero's attacks, we just have Cicero's texts. Antony and Cicero got into a oratorical slugfest in which they abused each other and accused each other of various crimes and so forth. Cicero eventually garnered quite a body of support in the Senate by pointing out that Antony was trying to do what Caesar had failed to do. His basic contestation was that Antony is the major threat. Antony is going to be the man who will try to take over Caesar's position and establish a tyranny over us. Backed then by the Senate, Decimus Brutus stood firm in his province. Antony was declared a public enemy. The consuls for 43 BC were instructed to go up and relieve Decimus Brutus at Mutina, who was besieged by Antony. And then Cicero pulled something of a masterstroke in terms of his political thinking. He decided to bring on board Octavian, who after all was sitting around Italy with legions. You can't have a man sitting around Italy with legions who you're not sure how he's going to behave. What's he going to do? Will he go and help Antony? What's he going to do? He brought Octavian on board by convincing the Senate to confer upon a guy who was only 19 years of age, actually 20 years of age in September 43, to give to him the command of a pro-praetorian legate, gave him the command of a pro-praetor, legitimize his raising of legions, legitimize his army, and let's use it for our purposes. This is basically Cicero's position. Clearly, they regard Antony as the chief threat. Octavian then takes on the pro-praetorian power and moves against Antony in Cisalpine Gaul. He joins the Senate and the consuls. Here's a really ironic situation. Here's Octavian, Caesar the son of Caesar, working for the relief of one of the men who had assassinated his father. Tells you something of the scruples of the man. He's clearly, at this stage, rather an opportunist. But he also wants to get even with Antony. So, the situation in Mutina then gets rather desperate. I should point out, at this situation, at this time, the other liberators, particularly Brutus and Cassius, who had been sent eastward by the Senate, were not idle. While this is going on in Italy, they are busy seizing provinces in the east and arming themselves. They have come to the conclusion that there's going to have to be a showdown with the Caesarian faction. So that wing of the conflict looks like it is not over and is in fact going to heat up at some time in the future. So Brutus and Cassius are in the east, arming themselves, the former liberators. Decimus Brutus is being besieged in Mutina. Antony and Octavian are on opposite sides of the fence, and the whole political situation is highly complicated, but basically is to be analysed as a two-sided power struggle, liberators versus Caesarians, and then a struggle for the leadership of the Caesarian faction between Antony and Octavian, also going on simultaneously. Well, to not go into too great detail about the events outside Mutina, what happens is that Antony finds himself bested outside of Mutina and is forced to retire into Trasalpine Gaul across the Alps, where he has major support from most of the governors of the western provinces, all of whom are pro-Caesar. They have been appointed there by Caesar. Caesar had taken it upon himself to appoint governors and magistrates 5 years in advance. Another sign of his complete disregard for tradition. He had just appointed the men, presumably because he was going to go away to Parthia, at least that's what he thought, to conduct a major campaign. So the governors then of the western provinces are all pro-Caesar, and they know Antony, they have worked with him, so as a result he goes to a pretty powerful base of support across the Alps. Outside Mutina, both the consuls for the year 43 BC had been killed in the fighting. So the state was now technically without consuls. And we have Octavian, as a pro-praetorian legate of the Senate, standing opposite a liberator who he's just helped escape a siege from Antony. Suddenly, Octavian's loyalty to his father's memory comes to the fore, and he refuses to cooperate in any way with Decimus Brutus, who wants to chase Antony across the Alps and pursue the war further. Octavian will have none of that. I will not cooperate with the murderer of my father. His family loyalties were suddenly rediscovered. It seems then that the Senate made a disastrous miscalculation. They, rather like Antony, they underestimated Octavian. They considered him to be still a mere boy. They honored Decimus Brutus. They granted him a triumph. They outlawed Antony further, and they ignored Octavian. He must have expected some form of legitimation, some form of recognition from them beyond his pro-praetorian legate, some form of thanks. Nothing was forthcoming. And the response by Octavian was decisive. He marched his army to Rome in October of 43 BC. And occupied the city on the 19th of October of that year. So now, for having brought Octavian on board, but then having snubbed him and ignored him, the Senate now had to put up with his military autocracy in the city of Rome itself. While he was in Rome, Octavian staged consular elections, and not surprisingly, he found himself elected. The position of consul for 43 BC, aged only 20. He also had the amnesty for the liberators rescinded. They were no longer unpolluted by the murder of Caesar, but were now to be declared enemies of the state. As a result of this then, in October of 43 BC, the situation is as follows. Antony has been thrown out of Cisalpine Gaul, but is amassing large forces across the Alps in Transalpine Gaul, and at about this time, maybe slightly beforehand, comes back into Cisalpine Gaul, into the Po Valley, with massive force, unopposed, and occupies the whole of the Po Valley. So he's entrenched in the north of Rome. In the east, Cassius and Brutus and many of the other liberators are building a power base for themselves, raising armies, seizing provinces, and preparing for war in the east. In Rome sits Octavian, in control of the city by virtue of having seized it in October, but his is by far the most perilous position. While he has the name of Caesar and he's using it to great effect, we hear from one of Cicero's Philippics that Antony once called him, "You boy who owes everything to a name." He's using it to great effect. He's nonetheless the weakest party in the power struggle so far. His position is by far the most perilous. He hasn't got the enormous military support of either Mark Antony to his north or the growing military power of the liberators in the east. He has to do something to secure his position, and what we'll see in the next lecture is that he decides to bury the hatchet with Mark Antony and form a pan-Caesarian alliance of sorts, but one that was to bring into play some of the very darkest moments of the Roman Revolution. The period then that we've surveyed in this lecture is a pivotal one for our story, not just because it establishes the developing power struggles on the one hand between the Caesarians and the liberators, and on the other, an even more important developing power struggle within the Caesarian camp between Antony and Octavian, but also because it has brought into play an actor on the stage of Roman politics who was to prove ultimately the most deft at the game of power play, and that is Octavian, who was to become the first emperor of Rome, known to us as Augustus. But that is the subject of our following two lectures.
Lecture 30, The Second Triumvirate.
Hello and welcome to Lecture 30 of the History of Ancient Rome, in which we're going to survey the events, broadly speaking, from 43 BC down to 36 or so BC. This was a period when Octavian and Antony joined hands and formed a body to run the state, effectively a military junta, called the Second Triumvirate, which we'll deal with. I'll explain that in due course. They also dealt decisively with the liberators in the eastern half of the empire, and then they divided the empire up between themselves and began to govern Octavian the west and Antony the east, with tensions, however, very, very quickly arising between them. This is the subject of the lecture today. We saw at the end of the last lecture how Octavian's position in Rome was perilous indeed. Antony was in Gaul, just in the Po Valley area, with enormous forces and major support from the western provinces. The liberators had in the east amassed an army in the region of 20 legions in strength, which was enormous by ancient Roman standards, and Octavian himself had a smaller force and was in control of the city of Rome, had himself elected consul, but was definitely the weakest party on the field at the time. He therefore put out feelers to Antony, and they patched up their differences in the course of 43 BC, late October and early November of 43 BC. The men met in northern Italy in Antony's province of Cisalpine Gaul, probably at Mutina or maybe at Bononia. The sources are not quite clear. And they had a two-day meeting that involved intense negotiations. The result was that Antony and Octavian joined forces to present a pan-Caesarian front. They brought into their agreement a third party, a man called Marcus Aemilius Lepidus, who was a leading lieutenant of Antony's, but as we'll see, was not nearly as effectual or ruthless a person as either Antony or Octavian. The three men decided that they would establish themselves by means of a tribunician law, which was passed on the 27th of November, 43 BC, as, quote, the board of three for the organization of the state with consular power. This effectively gave them dictatorial powers over the running of the state. This was a five-year grant of special power. It's known to the modern sources as the Second Triumvirate. Really, in essence, it should be called the First Triumvirate because it really is the only legally constituted triumvirate in our story, at least the only one that actually runs the state. We saw that the so-called First Triumvirate was actually an informal pact between Caesar, Crassus, and Pompey to work together. Well, the Second Triumvirate is a legally instituted military junta, is the best way to describe it, in control of the state and given legal powers to issue edicts and organize the state as they see fit. For the next decade, the triumvirate ruled Rome and dominated Roman politics. Elections were no longer held. The triumvirs simply nominated magistrates for 5 years in advance. But they got off to quite a bloody start indeed. They needed money. They had large bodies of troops who had been promised payment, land, and so on for their loyalties. And the triumvirs lacked money. And their first task, therefore, was to issue prescriptions. We haven't seen prescriptions since the days of Sulla. And if we recall, the act of prescription was the posting of names of enemies of the state in a public place, usually in the forum, and then it was basically open season on the people whose names appeared on those lists. Anyone at all, slave or free, friend, relative, personal enemy, anyone, could murder them and in fact be rewarded for the murdering of those people. All their land and property was confiscated, and this is of course where the source of money came into play, since all the land and property of the proscribed fell into the hands of the proscribers. Sulla, at least, had had substantial bodies of enemies in Rome when he set about his prescriptions in 82-81 BC, but the triumvirs of 43 BC couldn't really claim the same situation. Most of their serious enemies had fled east to join the liberators, and their actions were even more inexcusable than Sulla's. It was plainly motivated by a desire to get their hands on property to pay their troops. We have what purports to be the text of the prescription proclamation preserved for us in the Greek writer Appian, writing in the 2nd century AD, who claims to have translated the Latin proclamation into Greek. It's quite a chilling document. I won't read it all. It's quite long. But the justification offered in it by the triumvirs is that Gaius Caesar had spared his enemies and had been murdered by them for his troubles, and they weren't going to make the same mistake. And also, when I read the end of the proclamation, I intend to read to you the beginning and the end of it, notice how any effort to help or shelter the members of the proscribed, the people who were on the list, is punishable also by death. Quite a brutal and vicious proclamation. Here's how it starts. Marcus Lepidus, Marcus Antonius, and Octavius Caesar, the men appointed to regulate the Republic and restore it to order, declare, if it were not for the treachery of criminals who were pitied when they begged for mercy, and when they received mercy became enemies of their benefactors and subsequently conspirators against them, Gaius Caesar would not have been killed by men whom he took prisoner, spared out of pity, admitted to his friendship, and favored en masse with office, honor, and gifts. Nor would we have been compelled to deal en masse with those who have insulted us and proclaimed us enemies of the state. But, as it is, we observe from the plots laid against us, and from the fate of Gaius Caesar, that their evil nature cannot be tamed by kindness. And we would rather arrest our enemies first than suffer at their hands. No one should consider this action unjust or savage or excessive in the light of what has happened to Gaius and ourselves. A flimsy excuse indeed, since, as I say, most of the perpetrators had gone east and weren't in the city at all. And then the proclamation goes on with further justification along the same lines and ends with the following words. May fortune then bless our proclamation that no one is to harbour or conceal any of the persons listed below in this register or arrange to convey them anywhere else or be induced by payment to do so. If any person is discovered to have saved, assisted, or been privy to information about them, we regard such a person as one of the proscribed, and we exclude the possibility of excuse or pardon. No appeal, basically. It continues, the killers are to bring the heads of their victims to us. For each free man will receive 25,000 denarii, and a slave will receive his personal freedom and 10,000 denarii. Those, by the way, are substantial sums of money. And then the proclamation ends. The same will hold for informers, and to preserve the anonymity, the names of none of those who receive these rewards will be noted in our records. It's almost as if they recognize the essential criminality of their actions, and yet they continue to reward even slaves who murder their masters. The story surrounding the proscriptions in which 300 senators and some 2,000 knights and countless others perished are harrowing indeed, and are preserved in Appian, people hiding in sewers and cesspits and trying to claim friendship and loyalty from friends and allies and family members who then inform upon them. Horrendous stories. And the stories themselves of the proscribers, Lepidus, Antony and Octavian, are shocking. Lepidus, we hear, proscribed his own brother. Antony, one of his uncles. And Octavian prescribed a man who had brought him into the fold of legitimate politics, Cicero. The reason Octavian did this was that Antony, as we've seen, hated Cicero by virtue of their oratorical competition in the late part of 44 and early 43 BC. Cicero had become an inimicus, a personal enemy of Antony, and he wanted the man dead. Cicero is undoubtedly the most famous of the victims of the proscriptions. Cicero, we hear, tried to flee by boat, but couldn't take the motion of the sea. He was prone to seasickness and came ashore and stayed at one of the seaside villas. Soldiers of Antony's were out looking for him, and when they came upon his villa, he tried to flee once more down to the coast to get into his boat. But the soldiers, led, we hear, by a man called Gaius Popilius Lianus, whom Cicero had earlier defended in court and secured his acquittal in court, this man led the death squad down to Cicero as he was fleeing down towards the sea, and Cicero stretched out his neck and was decapitated on the spot. Apparently a messy job, because Linus was not an experienced executioner. Cicero's head and hands were then cut off and taken to Antony in Rome, who rejoiced at the killing and nailed Cicero's head and hands to the speaker's platform in the center of the forum. This being the very platform from which Cicero had disclaimed so many of his successful speeches, written with the hands, spoken from the head, now nailed to that platform. Lots of other heads joined Cicero's in and around the rostra. We hear of people decapitated while they were at dinner with their friends, the friends told to sit tight, don't move, and having to sit with the headless body well into the night for fear of themselves being proscribed. And a particularly horrendous story is that of the ex-praetor Gaius Tyrannicus, who was confronted by his death squad, begged for enough time for his son to plead with Antony for his life. And the death squad found this most amusing and responded to him, "He has already pleaded, sir, but to the opposite effect." So sons turning on fathers, wives turning on husbands, slaves turning on masters. Scenes of unimaginable mayhem and terror instituted immediately by the triumvirate. There is, by the way, a postscript to Cicero's execution, which I should tell you. Right up to the end, it seems, Cicero had expected that Octavian would save him, would intervene and rescind the execution order against him. It didn't happen, of course. We hear that years later, Augustus, as an older man, came to visit one of his grandsons who was reading a book of Cicero's. And the child, out of fear of evincing his grandfather's wrath, hid the book in his clothes. And Augustus said, "What's this book? Let me have a look." and it was Cicero's, one of Cicero's books. We hear Augustus pensively read large sections of the eloquence of Cicero, finally handed the book back to his grandson and said, "A learned man, my child, and a true patriot." What must have been going through his head when he knew that he was the one who had acquiesced in the killing of this great cultural icon, even in his own day? Anyhow, moving along, the situation then in Rome was, and in Italy, was quite chaotic as long as the proscriptions continued on into the year 42. The triumvirs also orchestrated the deification of Caesar, and a temple was begun in his honour, which still stands, at least the base of it still stands in the Roman Forum, on the site, we hear, of the pyre where Caesar had been cremated in the Forum shortly after his assassination. The deification of Caesar had the added advantage to Octavian of making him a son of God. And from now on, his name includes the phrase Divi Filius, son of God, which was only to add to his authority. With the armies now paid because of the proscriptions, the triumvirs could move against the liberators who were amassing their forces in the east. Antony and Octavian, it was agreed, would move east while Lepidus kept control of Rome and Italy in the rear. And to cut a long story short, the forces of the liberators, we can call them broadly the Republican forces, those still standing for a free republic against Caesarian, what they perceived as Caesarian tyranny, met in the double battle in October of 42 BC in the area of Philippi in Macedonia. Octavian, we hear, was ill and stayed most of the time in his tent. He was a sickly youth. And it was really Mark Antony who orchestrated the defeat of the liberators in these battles. Cassius and Brutus, the main leaders of the liberators, both committed suicide in the wake of these defeats at Philippi. And this effectively left the Caesarians, Antony and Octavian and Lepidus, in sole control of the Roman world. Supreme power, however, is a difficult thing to share. And the difficulties within the triumvirate were soon to emerge to become rather more obvious. The tensions within the triumvirate became obvious. Lepidus, for instance, was considered to be rather a minor figure. He had been brought into the triumvirate by virtue of his strength at the time when the negotiations took place, but he didn't marshal the same sort of respect. He hadn't got the same sort of connections that Antony and Octavian could claim. And he was gradually, in the wake of the defeat of the liberators, he was gradually sidelined and pushed into the rear. He was assigned a minor command in Africa. For the most part, the triumvirs had agreed, Antony and Octavian, the chief triumvirs, had agreed that they would take, respectively, Octavian would take the west, Antony would take the east. And following the defeat of the triumvirs in Greece, Antony, in fact, moved further east into his territories, where, in fact, he met Cleopatra in the town of Tarsus in Turkey and began his long affair with her that was to produce twins, male twins. Octavian returned to Italy and had a very difficult task on his hands. There were some 45 legions of troops to be dealt with. So many troops are very expensive to maintain, and Octavian decided that all but 11 of them needed to be settled. Land was required for the best part, well, more than 150,000 veterans. The practice at this stage for settling veterans, certainly it had begun earlier, it had been there since at least Sulla's time, was to settle veterans not in new colonies, in new foundations, but to settle them in established cities, to create what were often called double colonies, an established city with veterans grafted onto them. This meant, of course, that some people had to have their land confiscated from them to make room for the veterans. And this act of settling the veterans in the wake of the Battle of Philippi made Octavian enormously unpopular in Italy, especially among the people who were dispossessed of their land. It also created, we should notice, large bodies of dispossessed people who were now wandering the countryside and once more form a rather unstable and destabilizing element in the Roman Revolution. What happens next is a rather obscure affair that starts in 41 BC and revolves around Mark Antony's brother, Lucius Antonius, who was consul in 41 BC, and Mark Antony's wife of the time, Fulvia. These two began to foment